Portions of today's program are mechanically reproduced. And now keep your dial set on Channel 26 for the finest of television programming.
There is nothing wrong with your television set. Do not attempt to adjust the picture. We are controlling transmission.
Relief. You two take care of labor.
Only intended for a plane, Captain.
Danger! Danger! Man your stations! Vehicle in direct path of meteor storm!
You don't want to die of cold. Toll free.
Look, I'm a doctor, not an escalator. Spock, give me a hand.
I'll give you trouble!
Pop your piece around the track if you get...
Nails and more nails.
Have you ever tried to report a UFO sighting?
I'll save you the trouble. There is not a single government agency still in existence that will admit to any interest in the subject. If you seem to be insistent, they will refer you to a private organization.
You handsome, charming, specially marked boxes of monster cereals know. Inside one of these free wax lips, fangs, or mustaches, they just uncover the real you.
We now continue with Smurf.
Steve Austin, astronaut. A man barely alive.
Gentlemen, we can rebuild him. We have the technology. We have the capability to make the world's first bionic man.
The California mountains, there's a colony of aliens, explorers from deep space. They also control the Sasquatch.
Bigfoot?
That's right.
All funky colors. Shapes that swing.
That's impossible.
Robots? I call them fembots. The perfect women. Programmable, obedient, and as beautiful or as deadly as I choose to make them.
Really? They're robots.
And now part two of Kill Oscar.
Run! Wow!
Run while you can, boss.
Welcome to Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. I'm David Klein.
And I'm Troy Harkin. And David, we just passed a birthday for you. So I want to wish you a happy birthday. And along those lines of births, I became a grandpa recently too. So actually on the same weekend of your birthday. So we're celebrating new things.
Yeah, it was very weird with numbers and stuff like that, because everything comes down to numbers. I was born in 62, and I turned 62. So the math is just kind of playing with my head right now.
Yeah.
Very weird.
Damn that math. But yeah, we're really happy to have folks along. We've got a new season here, and we're going to have a lot of fun with this one, we think. I guess we're officially into it. So we should get going, because also we want to try to keep our shows a little tighter this season. Let's tell you what we're doing. This is season 6 of Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. And it's a season we're sort of parenthetically calling Two Old Farts Meet the Glass Teat. Now, many of you will be very familiar with the late, great sci-fi writer Harlan Ellison, who gave us the seminal works I Have No Mouth and I Must Scream, Repent, Harlequin, Said the TikTok Man, A Boy and His Dog, and many other legendary writings. Now, in the late 1960s, Ellison wrote an ongoing series of essays on television for the LA Free Press. In those articles, he claimed that television had great potential, but tended to fall short of that potential. He wrote that television didn't suck, rather that it was sucked, like a giant breast, like a glass teat. Now, despite his often scathing critiques of television, Harlan Ellison continued to work in TV as a writer and script consultant. Ellison won an Emmy for his work on Star Trek, but he also contributed to The Man from U.N.C.L.E., Star Lost, Twilight Zone, and Outer Limits. This season, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi, has something special in mind. It's our all-TV season. As I've said, Two Old Farts Meet the Glass Teat.
Well said, Troy. And our love of genre really did begin with television. Before we were old enough to read or even go to the theater, there was the omnipresent boob tube spewing out stories in glorious black and white. So this season, we'll be covering some of the shows that we loved from the era of the late 60s to the early 1980s. Shows that were kind of a big deal, shows that had influence, and are still well remembered by, you know, old farts like you and me, and hopefully by our listeners out there. In our first two episodes, we'll be looking at the television genre works of producer, director, creator, Irwin Allen. For those who don't recognize the name Irwin Allen, he was kind of the J.J. Abrams or Joss Whedon of his era. In 1960, Irwin Allen remade the dinosaur classic, The Lost World. And in the 70s, he gave us the disaster flicks, The Poseidon Adventure and The Towering Inferno, which inspired other cinematic calamities such as Earthquake and Roller Coaster. And I just watched 5 Weeks in a Balloon last night, which was quite fun. That was an early 60s one. So a fun fact, Allen won an Oscar in 1953 for his documentary, The Sea Around Us. Clearly, this indirectly led to his television show,
Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Bum, 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 bum. Now, Voyage ran for 4 seasons. It encompassed 110 episodes. It aired on ABC TV and ran from 1964 to 1968. And of Irwin Allen's 4 television series in the 1960s, his first, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, is the only one that didn't really require a pilot to sell to a network because it had already played as a successful motion picture in 1961. And that film starred Walter Pidgeon, Joan Fontaine, Barbara Eden, Peter Lorre, and Frankie Avalon. It's quite a cast. That's almost like one of our Schrodinger's cast type of things, where you've got Jeannie from I Dream of Jeannie and Peter Lorre and Frankie Avalon all together. As Voyage moved to the small screen, it upped the ante on its Cold War vibe. The world had changed. It had survived the Cuban Missile Crisis of October 1962, and James Bond was the hottest non-Beatles entity at the time. So it was natural that Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea would reflect these elements. And David, you want to tell us a little bit about the folks who starred in the TV version of this enterprise?
Yeah, Richard Basehart was Admiral Harriman Harry Nelson. David Hedison, and there's another Bond connection there because he was in a Bond film or two, was Captain Lee Crane.
And I just have to say that when I watched these on YouTube, he reminded me so much of the actor Jason Miller, who played Father Karras in The Exorcist. Like, I actually did a double take at first, thinking, is this the same guy? But sorry, David. And who else do we have?
I'm not sure of the pronunciation, but Robert Dowdell as Lieutenant Commander Chip Morton. I always thought Chip Morton almost sounded like the name of one of the guys that was a friend of the Hardy Boys. But that was Chet. Morton. Right?
Yeah, no, it has that feel. Like, it sounds like he could be an extra character with the Scooby-Doo gang.
Yes.
Yeah. Oh, no, Chip Morton. We left him behind. He's with Old Man Ferguson or whatever. David, I have to confess that I had never seen this show. I don't think I'd ever seen this show until I began prep for this episode that we're doing on Irwin Allen. And I think I know why. When I was a little kid, we lived in Halifax, and my dad was in the Navy as a weapons airman. And my mom, who was always a nervous Nelly, worried every time my dad went out to sea. So I'm sure she intentionally avoided ever having the show on, so she wasn't worrying about, you know, what what might go wrong at sea. She didn't want anything to stir up those anxieties. So unlike the other Irwin Allen shows we'll be dealing with, Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea was given a hard pass in our home. And frankly, I don't really remember ever seeing it in syndication as I got older. Did you watch this as a youngster, Dave?
Yeah, I did. It's possible. I'd have to ask my sister Carolyn, but we did watch a fair amount of stuff on TV when it was actually on. For example, Lost in Space, you know, that thing about how my mother, you know, came out the steps and said they've got Will. So I think we also watched Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Some of these shows we may have watched in the first run. For some reason, we were already interested in science fiction and fantasy. And I guess in some cases, some of the episodes touched on horror, even back in the mid to late 60s.
Yeah, and I do have to say, for folks who have not heard our very first episode, Blast Off, I recommend you go back to that. And that really was the germ for this season for me. Just I loved how we got into those elements, and particularly with you and Lost in Space. So here we are beginning a new season with all of that. So the show was, even though it aired during the Cold War of the 60s, of sort of the, I guess, the LBJ era, it was set in the 70s and 80s. So it is a future story, even though it's very mild how that plays out. Now, there's a few things that all Irwin Allen shows have in common. So like all Irwin Allen shows, we get a great featured vehicle. In Voyage, we get the submarine, the Sea View. We get lots of stock footage. We get canted shots and gimbals, so lots of on-set explosions, with a lot of smoke, a lot of fire. And by season three of this show, of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, we get to some pretty over-the-top episodes with titles like The Terrible Toys, Werewolf, Monster from the Inferno, Day of Evil, Night of Terror, The Plant Man, which is not quite, you know, the carrot from Lost in Space's Great Vegetable Rebellion episode, but it's not that far off. Now, another one that is in that realm of like totally absurd monster is The Lobster Man, which is in season four, it's episode 16. And it features, you know, a monster that is a lobster man. So lumbering around the set, like haranguing the sailors. And this totally reminded me of when I was at Seneca College way back, pre my U of T days, I made a Super 8 film called Demon Lobster. And it also had a lumbering lobster monster that was designed by hat tip to Ted Healy, designed by Ted Healy, who could make you any creature you ever wanted in about 30 minutes. And he could make it out of either foam rubber or cardboard and just using tape and glue. So thank you for that, Ted. Anyway, yeah, there were some pretty wacky episodes as the series moved on.
I got to tell you my lobster yes. man.
Okay. Yeah. Okay.
My lobster man story.
Hit me.
A few years ago, when Alexa was still around, we were at the Loblaws, which used to be Maple Leaf Gardens, where the Maple Leafs used to play. They moved and they turned that into a Loblaws. So Alexa and I are there, and there's this guy dressed up as a lobster having this container of lobster. And Alex and I made these comments about how, you know, you wouldn't pay us and not, there's no amount of money you would give us to have to do that. And what kind of, and you know, and this just, we weren't very nice. We weren't saying this right to the guy's face. It was just our own little comment, snide things. And I actually wrote a poem about that whole incident called The Lobster Man.
Oh, I think I know this one.
Yeah. And also, by the way, when it talks about, like, eventually Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea became a Monster of the Week kind of show. And in fact, when you mentioned it was, let me just go back to my notes here. You said it was 100. We could look at it as four seasons of 110 episodes, or you could look at it as four seasons of one episode repeated 110 times, because it just became a bit ridiculous. I just watched the other night in prep for this episode, an episode called The Mummy. So they're in the freaking flying sub, which is another beautiful, that's it got to be in the top 10 most beautiful science fiction vehicles. It was just, every boy and girl probably wanted to be in that flying sub in a leather jacket in those beautiful seats with those two controls flying in this thing. I mean, it was just beautiful. But the mummy, they've gone to some museum, they've got this freaking sarcophagus, you know, what could go wrong? And then they get it onto the sea view, and guess what? Things go wrong. So when you have werewolf, like at what point are you going to say, I've jumped the shark? Especially on a show in the sea.
Yeah, I've jumped the mummy.
One sacred sarcophagus, signed for, sealed, and delivered. I think the crisis is over.
Congratulations. How do you explain it?
You know, Lee, I think there are some things that are better left unexplained, huh?
Oh, my God.
Yeah, well, okay, I know in a minute we're actually going to be moving on to Lost in Space, but one of the things that cracked me up as I was going through the episode list of Lost in Space today was either how many episodes either the title either ended with blank in space or space blank. So like it might be like space werewolf, or werewolf in space, or like it just became a like, oh, that's how you pitch a story to these guys. You just either throw space in at the end of the title or at the beginning of the title. And then I swear to God, like maybe a third of all of their episodes are either named space blank or blank in space.
Wow. I've got one last thing before we move on from Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea is that my brother-in-law, that once I was mentioning to my brother-in-law, Rob Sawyer, about us doing an Irwin Allen, you know, looking at the various series, he said, right. Oh, well, I'm going to do an Irwin Allen festival. So he invited me over, and me and Rob and Carolyn watched an episode each from the various series that we're looking at.
Oh,
and
excellent.
Also the fantasy worlds of Irwin Allen. Now, the Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea episode we saw was season one, episode six, called The Sky is Falling. On my notes, and this will just take a second.
Yeah,
I just made some quick notes, which I can barely read right now. but at one point, Captain Crane says, I have no idea what the context is. He says, mermaids make lousy housekeepers. And I was thinking, that's a great line. So I had to write it down.
Yeah.
The episode basically has these flying saucers that are invading airspace. Like, they just don't respect airspace. What's going on here? But the aliens are interesting because they actually appear as them, as if you are talking to yourself. So when Admiral Nelson goes there, he is actually speaking to an alien, but that alien looks exactly like himself. It's just so smart and kind of brilliant. And then Kowalski at one point, I don't know the context of this either. He said, I finally found something better than girls. So I think I'll have to watch the episode again to figure out what the heck is he talking about. Then they also mentioned a man of courage, a man of curiosity. So and it was also rated very highly when Rob curated this little Irwin Allen festival. He picked episodes that were rated very highly. And for those fans of our show or listening, make sure you do watch The Sky is Falling, season one, episode six. It reminds me a bit of The Day the Earth Stood Still and also The Doomsday Machine. It's a very strong episode.
Wow. We have to do that sometime. And I know I was invited along and I felt I had something up, but that would be cool if we did it, an episode where we were like doing a festival like that, a marathon, And
well, it'd have to be, you know, it'd have to be $6 Million Man kind of thing or something like that, because Rob, that's one of his favorite shows.
But if we recorded almost all of it, and then we just like cut down like to like, you know, 30-second bits, like, oh my God, Kowalski, and this is better than Women for Him. I think Kowalski's been at, I think Kowalski's been at sea too long. I had one thing, just a note, and I said, Voyage is becomes a bit of a sausage fest, because I guess there was still that old superstition of having women on ships, that they probably thought, well, we shouldn't have too many women characters come up on this thing. But
yeah, that's been a concern a lot. And I think we will also get into the idea, which happens in Lost in Space and some and Land of the Giants and other ones, where you've got some women and maybe a kid on as part of the cast, and something happens, say, oh, well, let's leave the women. Remember when I came over to your place, we watched an episode and said, and you made the comment, let's just leave the women behind or whatever it was, because the men have to go out and do all of that kind of thing. But I also loved, Irwin Allen also goes back to people like Peter Lorre was in 5 Weeks in a Balloon, but he was also in the original Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea. Barbara Eden was also in the original movie Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, but she was also in 5 Weeks in a Balloon. So he has this way, which I think happens with some directors, where you have that sort of cast of people that you return to.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, yeah. You get the folks that you really do like working with. And I'm pausing, and I will cut this out. And Jonathan Harris ended up being in an episode of Land of the Giants later on after the run of Lost in Space. But I guess we are officially on to Lost in Space, which I guess is the premier series that we get from Irwin Allen, wouldn't you say? I mean, I feel like Lost in Space is really holds a place both in people's hearts, but also in the culture.
Absolutely. If people think about Irwin Allen, that's the one first one. And I think we've talked about it in parts in different episodes, you know, the robot getting large at one point, and also the pilot, the unaired original pilot that didn't sell, that didn't have Smith. It didn't have the robot. It would play straight up, and it was as if it was a serious thing, and it was quite amazing.
Yeah, it really was.
But then they changed it. And I think adding the robot and Smith was a good choice.
Yeah, for the long term, for sure. Well, folks, Lost in Space aired on CBS from 1965 to 1968. It aired 7:30 p.m. to 8:30 during what was called family hour back then. Lost in Space never ranked in the top 25 shows of the year. And I just wanted to sort of have a little talk about this, David. It amazes me how some of the shows, what I would say are the biggest shows of all time, and these are, again, ones that have a place in our heart and have a place in our culture, are not necessarily ones that had really long runs. So, you know, you get shows like Star Trek and Lost in Space and The Monkees and Batman that had like just a three-year run, but then almost immediately went into syndication and stuck with us for ages and are still well remembered. And yet there are other shows like, well, I'm just going to throw this one out there. But if you're, you'd have to be a little older than both of us to have a lot of memories of Gunsmoke. I mean, I barely remember Gunsmoke. Mm. And I think for a long time, it was the longest running show in television history.
Yeah, now, 20 years.
Now here, I'm just going to, I looked this up really quickly. So The Simpsons has the all-time record now at 35 and counting years. But the other shows that I will mention are genre-related shows that we cover. So leading the pack is Supernatural, which had 15 seasons. X-Files had 11 seasons. Smallville, 10. Then we get The Flash was 9. Charmed, Arrow, and Vampire Diaries had 8 seasons, and then we get 3 Star Trek shows, The Next Generation, Deep Space Nine, and Voyager had 7 season runs, and then we drop off, but we get like Sabrina the Teenage Witch was 7, Buffy was 7, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D. was 7. But But, you know, the ones that for us that really stuck out only had brief runs, but they had staying power. You know, they there was always something about them. And these Irwin Allen shows really do, like, really knew how to do it, right? Because, like you say, there's the robot, there's the spaceships, there's generally a villain, there's a kid. There's a lot of elements that just work. And I guess maybe this is a good point, too, to talk about the opening credits. You know, we mentioned earlier, you and I, when we were talking before the show, how you don't get a classic TV show with crappy credits or crappy theme song. Like, it all goes hand in hand. The show itself is good. The performances are good. And you get a really memorable visual opening along, like, married with a great theme. And I mean, again, you think of Star Trek, right? And if you have a really great show, you've got a great closing theme as well as a great opening theme. Mm. In the case of Lost in Space and a few of these other Irwin Allen shows, we had a very young John Williams creating the theme songs. And Lost in Space was lucky enough to have a couple of really good theme songs by John Williams. And we're going to play the two of them for you right here. That was the first one, and it's kind of trumpet heavy, and it reminds me of things of that era, like Henry Mancini and you know, like the James Last, and, you know, that kind of instrumental stuff. But I love the third season, and it really, it's not as kind of like music you would play at a party or something, but it's just this really great kick-ass theme. And again, married to these visuals of these kind of like silhouettes of the Robinsons, you know, going by the camera. And we get a similar aesthetic in all of the Irwin Allen. Well, not so much Voyage, but in Time Tunnel and Land of the Giants, you also get this like kind of stylized, almost like silhouette figures going by with this great opening music. Anyway, I mean, it's no wonder we're still talking about these shows.
With John Williams, it's kind of neat because the credit, I think it might have been Lost in Space, wherever the earliest or first one, has him listed as Johnny Williams, which sounds like a very boyish. I didn't look it up to see how old he was at the time that he was doing. I mean, we could speculate he might have been in his early 20s or mid 20s. I don't know. We'd have to look that up. But to actually have your name as Johnny Williams, then one of the shows that came after that, like, I'm not sure if it was Time Tunnel or Lost in Space, but it became John Williams instead of Johnny Williams.
Yep. And remained such, you know, until Spielberg brought him on board for pretty much everything.
One thing, Troy, quickly, because you mentioned the longevity of show. There's a couple things about that, one of which, and they're much better nowadays. Like there's been such a resurgence last 10, 20 years, these shorter series of 10 episodes, these kinds of things that they do where they, or The Expanse, where things are just the expectation of the viewer is so high. Like with Star Trek, the original series, it just started to peter off. It was a great first season. The second season was pretty good too. And then it just, like, there just wasn't that ability back then for a lot of those shows where they just ran out of ideas. One of the rare ones was, of course, with Rod Serling and Twilight Zone, it was strong throughout. The other thing is, I think there might have been a couple shows that we may have glossed over, one of which, even though there was a bit of a gap, is Doctor Who, which is going on for 60 years now or whatever the length of time. And the Stargate series went 10 or 12 seasons or so, 10. And then it had all these spinoffs that went a number of seasons as well. And it's strange because with X-Files and with Stargate and with Buffy and with Angel, these shows actually got better. And Star Trek The Next Generation, but that's explained because of Chaos on the Bridge and how bad the first couple of seasons were. But with these other shows, it just got better. They understood the characters, the writing got better, and it just became something great.
Yeah. Yeah, and I think if you can maintain, you know, it starts with, like, you know, a showrunner who has a really strong vision for the project. And then continuity of cast and continuity of in the writer's room, if possible. I mean, there's always changeover of some sort. But, you know, once you get that vision, and I'm a big fan of Big Bang Theory, and that's one that definitely, like, you know, it gets stronger and stronger as seasons go by. And everybody comes on board to what the show is. And sometimes, like in the case of that, I think the original vision, you know, they didn't really know what it could be. And it became something that just sort of evolved. Anyway, let's get into our sort of, is there such thing as a mini deep dive? A mini shallow dive? A shallow deep dive? I don't know. After the success of Voyage to the Bottom of the Sea, Irwin Allen began adapting the comic Space Family Robinson. And that is until lawyers stepped in to say that, I believe it was Disney, owned the rights to that particular Swiss Family Robinson spinoff. With the simplest of subterfuge, Allen rebranded the project Lost in Space without even changing the surname of the spacebound brood. And so there, all of a sudden, we had the first TV space fantasy of the 1960s. And it was an hour-long show of the three seasons. The first aired in black and white, while the second and third were in glorious color. And Dave, who was in this show?
Guy Williams as Professor John Robinson, June Lockhart as Maureen Robinson, Bill Mumy as Will Robinson, Marta Christian as Judy Robinson, Angela Cartwright as Penny Robinson, Mark Goddard as Major Donald West, who was the pilot, Jonathan Harris as Dr. Zachary Smith, and I guess it was Bob May was in the robot suit.
Dick Tufeld was the voice, yeah. And we also had Debbie the Bloop, the space monkey, which, of course, as a kid, anything with monkeys I loved, which is eventually how I got to Planet of the Apes, believe it or not. There was even a show, I don't know if you remember the cartoon Grape Ape, which is a Hanna-Barbera cartoon, Magilla Gorilla, of course. Anything monkey related, I think Irwin Allen knew kids would love. And he reminded me too, like, this is looking back at it, reminded me of Gleek from the Super Friends and Blip from Space Ghost. And so the monkey that played Debbie the Bloop was also a regular on Doctaria, another show that I remember from my early childhood.
Yeah, I used to watch that show too.
Yeah. So now you mentioned the pilot, and we can, you know, touch on a few things. So originally a pilot entitled No Place to Hide was shot, and that was basically their pitch film that was shown to the network. And there were a number of differences, right? As you were saying, David, like no robot, no Smith. The spaceship was not called the Jupiter 2. It was called the Gemini 12. And they show us that it launches on October 16th, 1997, which they kept in the actual aired pilot. Now, I thought it was brilliant that, you know, they created this little film, this original black and white pilot that the network had like copious notes about. And Irwin Allen was able to basically deconstruct it and use different elements, different scenes from the pilot, and insert them into episodes throughout season one. I just thought that was a great thing to do. If you already shot it, and like, yeah, don't just scrap it. Let's use this footage. And
that might be the second best usage of behind the menagerie, the two parts that they inserted, yeah, the unsold pilot, the cage. And the menagerie is, I think, one of the most underrated science fiction episodes.
Yeah.
Because it's just stunning.
Yeah. I love watching those episodes because you get the sense of where Star Trek could have gone. But anyway, they both stand up really well. So we can go through, there's a few notes basically about that original pilot. So what happens in the original version is it's not sabotaged by Smith. The mission is not sabotaged. Oh, and if for folks who want to know, we're told the family will spend 98 years in suspended animation. They are leaving the Earth because the Earth is cataclysmically overpopulated. Mm. Now, while they're asleep, the Jupiter 12 is hit by asteroids that do look suspiciously like rolled up balls of aluminum foil. We hear the voice from the space agency say,
Alpha Control's final analysis of the Gemini 12's flight indicates, unhappily, that the spaceship has either been destroyed or must be presumed lost in space.
Which is a great way to, you know, get to the opening credit roll.
Yeah.
We come back to a visual of the diary of Dr. John Robinson, as we hear his voiceover narration. The date is December 3rd, my birthday, 2001. We are told it's been 6 months since the crash. And that's when we meet Peggy's pet chimp, Debbie the Bloop, without any explanation to how they found her. She's just there. And later on in the actual TV episodes, there is a little bit of a scene where you find Debbie. And we constantly through the series actually do see June Lockhart displaying her home ec skills by doing laundry and dishes and whatnot. And that's just a kind of a funny thing to see now, you know. You definitely have that sense of, oh, if we were creating the series now, this is not how this would play out. And without Dr. Smith there for a foil, we have Don and John arguing with one another, which I found really odd that there was this tension between these two guys without Smith, because, you know, Smith actually brings them together on the show.
Right.
Which is a nice touch, because let's face it, as a dad, I can tell you, I would not be pleased after a little while with this guy and his overtures towards your daughter, even though you know that part of the mission must be repopulation, right? So there's got to be some weird tension there. Also in the pilot, Will plays Green Sleeves on an acoustic guitar, which is kind of cool. And that's again, we need to talk at some point about Billy Mummy, who like, what an amazing character he is. Like, I realized that, you know, if I had a short list of people in genre that I would like to be able to sit down and talk to for a half an hour, he would be there. He would be on that list, right? Just for the things that he's done. you know, having been on the Twilight Zone,
yes,
having been in these memorable Twilight Zone episodes, going on to this show where basically, you know, the show can be in a weird way boiled down to Will and Dr. Smith and the robot, especially as it moves on. Like, that was not the intention of it originally, but I think they just became, the three of them became fan favorites, and their interactions, you know, were pretty juicy. And it was just, it was cool that he was able to play, play guitar, and he does it later on too. And it's actually a little bit of a Beatlesism I will give you now, Dave, that there's an episode in season three. Let me check my note on this. Season 3, episode 13, called Castles in Space, in which Will and Judy sing Sloop John B, the song. And it's a cover song. It's an old traditional song that was made famous in 1966 when the Beach Boys included it on their Pet Sounds album, which was hugely influential on the Beatles and them getting to record Sgt. Pepper. So I just thought it was cool that that's one of the songs that we see Will play on Lost in Space. What the heck is my note here? Sorry. So even though the pilot episode is set in 2001, Irwin Allen thought the folk boom of the 1960s had enough staying power to reach the next millennium. But realistically, Will might have been playing a hit from 1997 when they left the Earth. So he might have been playing Hanson's Mbop or Blur's song too. Woohoo! that didn't happen. Yeah. Anyway, we can actually move on from the pilot if you like, David, or do you want to spend some more time on it, or what do you want to do?
Well, the pilot also introduced us to the chariot, which is another beautiful design, if you want to mention that.
Yeah, no, that's true. And you know what? There's a lot that I didn't know about Lost in Space before we started in on this. But so the chariot, which is the sort of like this Land Rover all-terrain vehicle thing, that that they have aboard the Jupiter 2. Not the Jupiter 2 in the original, but anyway. And it's got this sort of glass enclosure, plexiglass, whatever. Mm-hmm. And it's a modified snowcat, which is, if you remember The Shining, that is the vehicle that Scatman, Dick Halloran, brings up to Wendy. Mm-hmm. And Wendy escapes in it. So that is a snowcat. And and that's what the chariot is. It's a modified one. They put this whole glass thing on top of it, and it looks like they probably elongated it or something. But I thought that was kind of cool.
Oh, yeah. Oh, and if you want to talk about Beach Boys for a second, they also, I just watched this past weekend, there's a documentary that's been released recently on the Beach Boys.
Right, on Disney.
A lot of great, really good.
Yeah, yeah. No, I did enjoy that. So the original unaired pilot features music by the great Bernard Herrmann, who, among many other things, also gave us the brilliant Psycho score. After the pilot was shown to CBS executives, they came up with the idea of adding Smith as a stowaway nemesis, and of course the robot, because kids love robots and robot merchandise. But he wasn't always friendly, was he? In those early episodes.
And so yeah. Definitely. In fact, he was dangerous, and he was being programmed by Smith, and he was going to do damage, like whatever it was. It could be very menacing.
Yeah. And it was actually Rob Sawyer who mentioned on our previous live robot show that, because sometimes people do make the mistake of thinking he's Robbie the robot, which he is not. He's designed by the same person, but he's not. And again, as Rob said, he's actually only ever, when not just referred to as the robot, there is the identification of the B9 robot, which I thought was hilarious. B9. He's friendly. He's benign. It's okay. It'd be funny if they did have like some sort of like malignant robot or something.
Yeah, and I think there was an episode of Lost in Space where Robbie the robot makes an appearance. So it's
There's at least two, and I think there's a third. There's one called The War of the Robots, which is a great episode. I might actually I've got a little note on it. So War of the Robots was season one, episode 20. Robbie the Robot appears for the first time as Robotoid, a robot with free will. And he's in one later on called Condemned of Space, where he's the robot, sort of a guard. That's it, a prison guard. He's a robotic prison guard. Wow, that's a technical phrase. there's a very cool spacewalk scene, too, in that one where Dr. Robinson has to rescue the robot who was floating off in space due to Smith's negligence. And it looks pretty good. Like I was surprised watching it how good it looked, and it must have looked amazing at the time, because it looked like both the robot and Dr. Robinson are weightless. Like they really do look like they're in zero gravity, floating around, but it's all just wire work, right? So the producer continued to tweak both Dr. Smith and the robot. And for the first few episodes, both were still a little too intimidating for the children and the family hour. The robot was more Cylon than C-3PO, and Dr. Smith's earliest appearances had a menacing Alan Rickman vibe to them. But after the first half dozen episodes or so, they were both the bumbling boobies we'd come to know and love. And the Robinsons went from calling the robot it to him. Frequently in the later episodes, they'd all refer to being fond of the robot whenever it was in jeopardy. And I guess we really do need to give Jonathan Harris his props. It was one of those performances that used to bug me, but I think that's the intention. You know, he is not supposed to be the character you're rooting for. So yeah, seeing him every week could be a little grating. But so Harris was given the freedom to rewrite his dialogue. And that's where we get the very specific patter of Dr. Smith, including his alliterating Smithisms that he heaped upon the robot. I think we should do this, Steve. You and I should get into alliterating insults. So I don't know if you want to try it.
Pusillanimous?
Yep.
Pipsqueak?
Yeah. You Neanderthal nincompoop?
You lame-brained lump?
You negligent ninny?
You blithering booby?
I used to conflate Jonathan Harris with Ray Walston from My Favorite Martian, and I actually had to Google My Favorite Martian to see that it was not Jonathan Harris.
For the actual festival, we watched the Lost in Space episode, season one, episode 7, called My Friend Mr. Nobody, which was written by someone who also wrote 53 episodes of Perry Mason. But My Friend Mr. Nobody sort of featured Penny. It was a very strong episode for her, because there was this cave, and there was this voice talking to her. So she would go back to the family and say, there's this voice in a cave and he's my friend now and I'm talking to him, and they just didn't believe her. So after everything that they've been through, if your daughter says, well, there's this something that I'm talking to, you might want to listen to her.
Yes. Yeah, give that a go.
Yes.
Yeah.
But very strong and a very cool moment, which I know sounds really odd. But at one point she's going in, and there's this rock thing. It pushes or opens up, and then she says to whoever's in the cave, remember to count to three. 1, 2, 3. When the door opens, please. So basically that was so smart, because she must have done that because it closed too quickly on some earlier visit, and she had to talk to it to be able to explain that this is how you do it. So I thought it was very smart the way she did that.
Yeah, there really were some great episodes. Like, you know, sometimes people from the show have talked about the supposed Batman effect of how once Batman hit the airwaves, they kind of had to not, I don't want to say dumb down it, because you know I love Batman, but they got campy and it got sillier. You know, that first season, particularly because it's in black and white, it gives it a sort of a more serious tone, kind of a sense of gravitas. And then the show does get sort of diluted down to just, again, Will and Dr. Smith and the robot. And I just realized, isn't Will Smith? Will Smith was in iRobot, right? Isn't that a weird thing? Will Smith, the robot? Anyway, I'm going to let that one go. But yeah, there are a lot of great episodes. You know, you love the show, you know this already. But if you don't know the show, I mean, if you can find the box set, it's out there, it's available. There are some great ones I particularly like. There's just a few that I liked. I'm just going to tell you. Trip Through the Robot, I really liked. I just actually today watched Mechanical Men, in which something really cool happens. First of all, they used the merchandise of the robot, of all these toy robots, and they brought them into the sets, into the story, where there's this world of these miniature robots, and the robot becomes like the king of them. And and that's still not the end. This was a cool touch. They do this Freaky Friday thing where the robot and Smith go into each other's bodies. So the robot sounds like Dr. Smith. And Dr. Smith does this, Harris does this great performance where he's like moving around like the robot. And clearly they lip synced the robot's voice to Smith's. So he wasn't imitating the robot, but they synced it up. Anyway, that's kind of a cool episode. And there's that one we mentioned, Condemned to Space, The Antimatter Man. There's a really silly one called The Great Vegetable Rebellion that everybody wants to talk about. I think we all kind of have fond memories of this show. But the thing is, like so many television shows of this era, you're not just, you know, today you can wrap up a show with sort of prestige television, you know, but back then you were really answerable to not just the network, but to the sponsors. So if somebody decided in the middle of the summer that your show wasn't coming back, you weren't coming back. And even in the case of Star Trek, you know, like you can only have so many letter writing campaigns before your sponsors decide, nope, I don't care. We're not bringing this thing back. So the question is, David, how it all ends. If we could, you know, come up with a way to give proper closure to a show like Lost in Space, and given the chance, you know, how would you have concluded the series?
Which is a great question, because not every series is given that chance, but certainly more recent times shows know if you've got a big enough run, like whether it's Big Bang Theory or something else, you know when it's going to be your last season and you can actually plan it properly, whether it's MASH or whether it's Friends or whatever the show is. There's more of an opportunity now. So for me, if you want me to start.
Sure.
They do just like and the greatest series to actually have a proper kind of, you know, you're going away and you actually get back is, of course, Voyager, because Janeway does get them home. Oh, sorry, spoiler alert. Oh, we're not doing spoiler alerts. So anyways, so that is how I envisioned Lost in Space. They've got to get, however it is, they have to get back home. You know, Sliders never finished. They never got to get back to their parallel Earth and so on. So with Lost in Space, what happens is they do get to, and it wasn't just them on their own. They were going to some system where it's almost like the old West, heading out, homesteading, and actually building communities with other people. So there are other Jupiter 2s and other ones that were all going off to the same place. So they would all be able to stake out a place, but eventually commingle and eventually build a whole community. So for me, they get to that destination. Dr. John Robinson and Maureen Robinson, they actually put up a bar. And they just invite people over and they all have drinks. So that's their thing. Major Don West and Judy Robinson get married and they start a family and she becomes an IT specialist. Bill Mumy is Will Robinson. He actually Judy becomes the IT specialist, but Major Don West becomes a sommelier. So anyways. So
sorry, Bill Mumy, he becomes a
sommelier.
I thought you said a wine.
No. Will Robinson becomes a director, sort of a la Ron Howard.
Oh, nice.
Angela Cartwright as Penny Robinson becomes a teacher. She actually teaches Russian literature of the 19th century.
Oh,
and it's strange that that happened. And then Jonathan Harris, Dr. Zachary Smith, goes into politics, and he's on the ticket for the sort of the whatever the version of the alt-right campaign is on Alpha Centauri.
Oh, I like that.
So that's basically what happens to the cast of Lost in Space.
From
my perspective.
I like that a lot. I like that you took the brief and you ran with it and you got some really, I want to see that. Like, I think we write that script now, because even if it's fanfic, because I want to see how that plays out. Well, I have two quick ones for you. And like the other one just came to me today. I thought, what if we were to do it literally as Lost in Space? What if we wrapped it up where Smith actually, as in the original, well, the original aired pilot, he actually meets his objectives and he kills everyone aboard the Jupiter 2, and the whole season has been a dream in their afterlife, and they just need to realize that they're actually dead. That's my simple sort of one that just hit me today. It's like Lost in Space. Mm. And here's the one that originally I thought, this is the one that I wanted to. And okay, so let me give you the scenario. Will wakes up in his cabin upon the Jupiter 2. He looks very agitated. He gets up slowly and tells the robot he's had a bad dream, a very bad dream. He says he remembers who he really is. He says he's from a place called Peeksville in Ohio. Will says Dr. Smith drugged him and kept him asleep. He dreamt he was lost in space with his family. They told him his name was Robinson, but it's not. The boy turns from the robot and goes to Smith's quarters. Mm-hmm. He wakes him up and says, "You're a bad man. You're a very bad man, and I don't like you." Smith whimpers and pleads, and then the boy wishes him into the cornfield. The man vanishes. The boy slowly walks out of the shot, and we see the robot behind him. The robot says, "That's a good thing that you did, Anthony. That's a real good thing." And we fade to black.
Nice.
And then we hear, do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do-do. So a little bit of the Bob Newhart thing going on, where we take a previous show that Bill Mumy had been in to pay off this one.
Very nicely done.
Yeah, I want to see that one too. But, you know, whether this is your first time listening or your 71st, we want to thank you for joining us. You are the reason that we do the show. However you listen, we'd ask you to please like, rate, review, and subscribe on whatever platform you use. Please do tell others about the podcast. You can join us on our Facebook page, Two Old Farts Talk Sci-Fi. You can engage with us there or over at our website, 2, that's a numeric 2, 2of.ca and let us know what you think. And that, Dave, I think is our show, unless you have something else we should add here.
I think that's it, other than just one very small thing, which is Trip Through the Robot, which was kind of interesting because my sister Carolyn and I wrote a poem based on that episode, Trip Through the Robot, and it got accepted in a robot anthology. So we're kind of excited about that.
So this is a new one.
Yeah, yeah.
Oh, that's great news. Congratulations.
Oh, you're welcome. I mean, it was one of those iconic episode. I mean, it's one of those episodes that just stuck in the mind. The idea of walking inside an enlarged, it almost brings it into Land of the Lost, which Land of the Giants, which we'll get into later in a later episode.
And there was like this claustrophobic feeling, I recall, because doesn't the robot start to shrink down too while some of them are in it? Like,
yeah, while they're trying to get out in time.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. Yeah. Very good episode. And a good congratulations.
Thank you. And we'll see everyone for part two of our Irwin Allen retrospective.
And we're looking forward to having everybody back. I'm Troy Harkin.
And I'm David Kling.
And you're listening to Two Old Farts
Talk Sci-Fi.
Lost in Space will return next week at its regular time over most of these stations.
Over most of these stations.
I said that.
He said that.